In Acts chapter 18, this is my general Google Maps view of what I call the Bible lands, but obviously we want to be a little closer in on some of these things. So when we are talking about our general situation right now, what portion of Paul's work is this that we're talking about right now? All right. Second journey. So he's on his second preaching tour, second preaching journey. Where did he start this particular preaching journey? Antioch of Syria, where he starts all preaching journeys, right? We, of course, had looked at this before, and of course, Antioch of Syria is way down here. First missionary journey or first preaching tour went this way and came back, and then but this one's going all the way up here. Now we're at where? Corinth, which is on which peninsula? Everybody knows this. The Peloponnese Peninsula, right? Say that three times fast. Peloponnese Peninsula, this one right here. And it is technically a peninsula, though. In the 1800s, it became an island because they put the canal through. There's a canal through now right here, so technically it's surrounded on all four sides, as it were, by water. The way God made it, it's a peninsula. We are of course concentrating now on Corinth, which is here on the Peloponnese Peninsula, about 50 miles away from that other city, Athens. You note that Corinth is right on the edge of the peninsula, and it's really a rather large peninsula. We have a tendency to think that Corinth is everything regarding this, but it turns out that it's not. It's just a minor portion of that island, and there are people and towns all over the rest of this peninsula. But we focus, of course, on Corinth. But what that, of course, tells us is that, and we'll see that in the slides today, Paul was there for how long, at least? At least a year and a half, right? And one could think that given his propensity to go about teaching the gospel, that he didn't remain in Corinth, though I'm sure he could have. But, and of course, anything that we could think about him going anywhere else on the Peloponnese Peninsula would be just speculation. But certainly it was Paul's habit, you might call it, to go about preaching the gospel. So it'd be nice to think that indeed he did get away from Corinth and get out here to some of the other folks and preach there also. So, but we have no record of that. All right, so that's where we are. You recall that we sort of zoomed in on Corinth a while ago and looked at the fact that the temple of Aphrodite, which you could see up on this big hill up here, which was, what did I say, was about 1,200 feet above where Corinth itself was. You could look at that from down here in the town, and it would just loom above you, and you could see the temple area up here. And of course, this is the ruins of Corinth here. And you'll remember we talked about the bema, or the speaking platform, that was in the marketplace that Paul might have spoken from, because this was the public speaking area right here. And at one time, if we get down on ground level, you can see, you know, what you might see from approximately that area. So if you're looking out to the north, you can see that gulf that's out there. I forget what it's called. It's on the western side of that spit of land that goes from Athens to Corinth. And of course, as you look around, you can see back over to the mainland over here. And as we go around and look behind us, we can see that big hill behind us that has the temple of Aphrodite on it. So when you're in Corinth and just walking around, you can see this all the time. And so that would be a reminder, I think, to Paul about the things that were similar to what he saw in Athens. What did he see in Athens?
Idols
everywhere, right? Even an idol to what? The unknown God. And so that's what he says, I set forth to you. And so as Paul was speaking, perhaps from this platform here, perhaps anywhere, any number of places, in the city, he would have been able to see this hill that was behind him with really just pointing out the idolatry that was in that city. And once again, as I mentioned, I like to get into it like that so that I have some idea, perhaps, of what Paul and the others might have actually seen. It helps me to visualize what was going on. And sometimes when people talk about things like all the idolatry that was going on and realize that this temple of Aphrodite was around, that you can realize that all they had to do was just look off to the south there and they could see this mountain, as it were, that was just so much higher than the rest of the land around them. And it had that temple on there. That was just a big reminder to not only the idolaters, but now the Christians, of the idolatry that went on in that particular area. You'll remember that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that I did look up, because a lot of times you see, you know, we have history books from the 1800s and things like that. And when we look at those history books, it appears that the authors sometimes made up or what would you say, stretched the ideas of some of the things that they had. And so when they say 1,000 temple prostitutes, you know, that wasn't really 1,000. Maybe it was just 4. And, you know, it was a common practice, apparently, in that area and in many areas. And it's a common practice, apparently, in the idolatrous countries today to have temple prostitutes. And it was not unheard of to have a temple that was filled with prostitutes for the purpose, supposedly, of worshiping the god. We looked at this map just a minute ago, one similar to it anyway, to show Paul's, this is actually his first and second preaching tours, but the one in red, of course, is the one that we're concerned about right now. And we're essentially, sort of physically, about halfway through the journey. But this certainly isn't the end of it. We'll continue on there. And then once again, just a quick look at the fact that this is the Peloponnese Peninsula. And when we're in the city of Corinth, there was this temple of Apollo that was down there, and you can see that in the ruins now. This is what they've managed to recover and set up, and a good picture showing up to the area where the temple of Aphrodite would have been. So a big reminder throughout that city of the idolatry that went on around there. And so, much like Athens, even though Corinth and Athens were sort of not enemies but competitors with one another. And, of course, then we looked at this before. The Temple of Apollo, of course, right in the middle of town, as it were, and the Temple of Aphrodite is way over here up on the mountain. So this is just, as was mentioned a couple of weeks ago, downtown Corinth here. So it was certainly much more extensive than that. When we look at the fact that Paul was in Corinth for, as we mentioned, these 18 months, we can see this mentioned in Acts 18th chapter, and verses 9 through 11. Would someone like to read verses 9 through 11 of Acts 18? David?
Chapter 18, 9 through 11. And the Lord said to Paul in the night by a vision, "Do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking, and do not be silent. For I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in this city." And he settled there a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them.
All right. God told him not to be afraid of what was there. Did he have reason to be afraid of the people that might be there? Who especially?
The Jews.
Fortunately, the folks from Thessalonica who'd followed him around a bit way up there in Macedonia hadn't followed him all the way down to Corinth. But we see that the Jews are very zealous to have their way and to reject the teachings many times that Paul had to say, and the people that were with him, the other preachers that were with him. But God told him not to be afraid. And so he received this encouragement from the Lord regarding that. He says, "I have much people in this city." Now, when we look at the letters of 1st and 2nd Corinthians, we realize that Paul wrote these letters to them from Ephesus and from Macedonia, as I recall, wrote those letters to them because he was concerned about them. But we realize that these people were in certain places strong and in certain places they were weak, just like many of the others of us. But we realize that there certainly was a congregation there in Corinth Where does it look like perhaps they met? Mickey brought this up a couple of times last week. Or when Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, decided to believe and become a Christian, where did he resort to? The house of Titus Justus, right? Which was where?
Right next to the temple.
Not the temple, but the synagogue. As a matter of fact, in the American Standard Version, it says hard against the synagogue, I believe it says. 7. Whose house joined hard to the synagogue. Randy, what does New American say?
New American Standard says whose house was next to the synagogue.
Next to the synagogue, yeah. So with the American Standard saying whose house joined hard to the synagogue, I almost get the idea that they might have shared a common wall. You know, and that would not be unheard of in a place like that. That when people build, they would only need to build, as it were, 4 walls instead of 6 or something like that, and if they had another wall that they could get onto. All right. So Titus Justus, of course, was right next door, and we see that, as was mentioned last week, that Crispus went over to Titus Justus's house. So we might suppose that the church met there. So indeed, there were many people in the city. We can see that Paul wrote to them a couple of times and mentioned them. And then also in Romans, the 15th chapter and verse 31, Paul writes in another occasion about being delivered. Randy, do you have that? Romans
15:31.
Yeah.
That I may be rescued from those who are disobedient in Judea, and that my service for Jerusalem may prove acceptable to the saints.
Okay. So in this instance, in Romans, of course, he's talking about the fact talking about the disobedient in Judea. But we understand that the disobedient seem to be around him everywhere. And when we looked at those in, was it Iconium, talked about them being disobedient, the Jews in the synagogue. I'd have to go back and look for sure. But we see that we've seen this before, that these are the people, when it says disobedient, who were not following the word of God. Paul had preached it to them. Many of them believed it. But when they realized that there were other things going on, in other words, the Gentiles were listening to this and they were believing it, that they thought, well, you know, this really isn't just a sect of Judaism, this is a separate religion, as it were. A lot of these Jewish people got upset about that and they became disobedient. So they heard the word of God. Some of them may even have started to believe it, but they were either talked out of it or they decided that this wasn't for them. So when we talk about disobedience, that's, I think, what we're looking at. And so God knew that there are many souls, there are people. The Greek word here is laos. You look that up in the New Testament, you find it occurs about 140 times. So it's just simply a word that means people. So that there are many souls or people that would obey the gospel. I think we can see indeed that was the case in the city of Corinth, that people did obey the gospel. Randy?
The disobedient Jews following all around and persecuting them in every city. It always makes me think, my mind goes back to John chapter 11.
John 11.
After Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead, and, you know, you can't deny that miracle.
Nope.
He's been dead for 4 days. And it says in verse 47, therefore the chief priests and the Pharisees convened a council. And they were saying, what are we doing? This man is performing many signs. If we let it go on like this, all men will believe in him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. So these are the leaders of the Jews. The leaders of the Jews are saying, we can't deny he's performing miracles.
Right.
But we can't let him go on like this because we're going to lose our place. You know, our political clout, our power, and all these things. It's all about us. It's all about me, myself, and I.
Indeed.
And so it's a matter of refusing to believe. Willful ignorance.
Right, willful ignorance, yeah. The refusal to believe is the thing, is that the evidence is there before you. You can see it. You can realize that it lines right up with the scriptures that you've known and studied all your lives. And you said, but it doesn't fit my plans. And that was, that I think, their problem.
And so those who were following him are followers of these leaders. These are the leaders.
Yeah.
Those are the followers.
Sure.
And they are believers in men.
Sheeple.
Followers of these leaders.
Yes.
They're saying, no, we're in charge. You listen to us, we're in charge.
Sure.
God put us in charge, so you listen to us.
Yeah.
You're not on God's side.
Yeah. Randy Bowles.
Yeah, I completely agree with Randy. That's one of the biggest problems that Paul ran into in every city, that when these Jewish leaders of the synagogue or wherever they went, that when they began to see the popularity of Paul in the sense that many of the Jewish people began to agree with him, they sensed the loss of power, sensed the loss of prestige, and that's why they had the willful ignorance to oppose him. And then especially when he turned to the Gentiles, it was even worse. It was like pouring gasoline on the fire.
Oh, yeah.
And we love to look at individuals like that, whether it's the leaders of the Jews in Jerusalem in Jesus' time, or these Jews here in these various cities, Paul encounters. But it's the same problem each of us are faced with when we begin to study the Scriptures and somebody presents for us an idea that we simply say, oh no, that's not according to how I've always understood. Do we throw up a wall and just say, nope, not going to listen? Or do we take the approach of, that's interesting, I've never seen this before. What, you know, let's study this together and approach it with an open mind. And so often we take the former. We say, nope, don't want to talk about it. You're wrong. I know you're wrong. And that's problematic for two reasons. Number one, you could be missing out on an opportunity to learn the truth. Number two, you're missing out on an opportunity to perhaps, possibly, persuade someone of the error of their ways.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
It's still something we have to be careful of, to be always in search of the truth and always having honest hearts.
Well, why were the Bereans more noble than the other people? They had searched the Scriptures. They studied, as you mentioned, and they looked, they studied these things out as Paul and the others were speaking to them about it, and they were what you would call, they would have, what kind of characteristic would you call that? I'd call it honesty, right?
It's honest heart.
And but when we look at these rulers that are mentioned in John, we understand that really they couldn't have honest hearts because evidence was presented to them. They saw it and they determined to reject it. Unlike who here in Corinth? A prominent person here in Corinth mentioned.
Crispus,
the ruler of the synagogue.
It's hard to do that because we see what we have in here and now,
mm-hmm.
in the way of whether it's prestige or position, power. But when you're standing before the Lord on the day of judgment, all of that prestige, power, position, whatever, it will be nothing. It will be absolutely nothing.
Right.
That's what we have to keep telling ourselves, to be looking towards that goal of heaven, not looking at the here and now.
It's a hard thing for us to let go of this world, isn't it? I mean, we live in the world, and it is very easy for us to become of the world. And so all of us have a certain amount of the world in us, some more than others. And we have to make sure that we just keep in front of us the fact that this is not the last place. This is just the testing place, the whatever you want to call it. This is just a temporary place before we receive an eternal reward or judgment. James.
Well, speaking of temporary riches, besides just prestige and power,
a lot of the Jews, too, had this idea that things were going to be like they were in the days of the United Kingdom, where they were Saul, David, and Solomon. So they were hoping that Jesus was going to come and sit on this earthly throne and we're going to be like we were back in the old days, when that wasn't the plan to begin with. And passages like 2 Samuel 7 and Jeremiah 31, beginning verse 31, God made it very clear, and people like Crispus, who were honest, saw this, that old law, that whole covenant system, was there for a time. It was never intended to be permanent. It was temporary. So the honest Jews that saw that were looking for the coming of Christ. They were looking for the fulfillment of those prophecies. And by this point in time, he is dead, risen from the dead, and gone back up to the right hand of God. But they were presented with the evidence that they needed, and they accepted it and responded to it and became children of God. So you really have those two elements. You've got the people that don't want to lose their job. They want to be the high and mighty celebrities of the day among the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. But you also have people that are looking for something that was never going to happen to begin with. Jesus clearly said, my kingdom is not of this world. So you have people looking for some physical entity that was not going to exist.
That's right. Right. Mm-hmm. And correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't it one of Jesus' disciples in the gospel that says, dost thou not at this time restore the kingdom?
Oh, yeah. Acts 1.
Yeah. And so, well, now these folks have been with him for 3 years, and they asked that question. They didn't rightly understand. Perhaps they didn't want to understand, because it certainly permits them to look forward to more prestige than they've got right now. We've never been in bondage to anyone, they said. That's just not true. It's just not true, and it wasn't true at the time that statement was made. David, you had something?
I had that look on my face.
You had the hand going like, I'm going to put it up.
Yeah. I was just thinking about what Randy said, and I could see Paul doing that very same thing. He took that approach back in Athens. Because he had all these idols, and one with the unknown God inscription on it. He could have said, no, these are all wrong, you're all wrong for worshiping me, but no, he took it to his advantage and said, let's talk about this unknown God, and he introduced the true God,
right,
and taught them about the true God. So he didn't just say, like Randy was saying, let's study this together, instead of saying, no, you're wrong, and I see Paul doing that there.
Yeah, it's not a matter of, Matt, you're all going to hell. Get back to me when you change your mind. You know, it's that generally doesn't work. I'm not sure that it ever worked. You know, some people may be shocked at that and think about things, but generally, yeah, it would not work. And so, Paul took something that apparently somebody at least was interested in, and about the unknown God, and spoke to them about that and how important it was. And so what he spoke to them about this unknown God was different than all the gods that they had known, that they had set up. This was the God that created the heavens and the earth. None of their gods had done that. You mean, are you getting ready again?
I was going to also say about the Jews took that authority approach when they crucified Christ, because they scared Pilate by saying, we got a law.
Oh, yeah.
And Pilate became more afraid, because if he doesn't keep them calm and let them do their thing, his position is going to be gone.
Yeah.
So they had a way of twisting it to their own
to their advantage. Yes, that's right. And I think the thing is that the comparison between those folks and John and a bunch of the people that we've been talking about and Crispus is just amazing. Crispus, obviously, was an honest man. He was the leader of the synagogue, yet he looked at what Paul outlined and said, that's right. I need to fix my life. That's what I need to do. And that's what he did. And we realize that once that happened, he became no longer ruler of the synagogue, right? How do we know that? So later on, when they brought Paul before Gallio, who did they beat? Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue. So you see that Crispus was not the ruler of the synagogue anymore. Continuing the encouragement by the Lord, When Mickey says this may refer to the why none would hurt him, we look at the idea behind Gallio in starting in verse 12. So when we look at the discussion that goes on from verse 12 through verse 17, we understand that this was a person who could have harmed Paul and had the authority to do so, but Gallio wasn't interested in that. And it wasn't a matter of that he was, you know, an honest man that wasn't interested in these people that were trying to bring Paul up on trumped-up charges. It's just that, period, he wasn't interested in them. I think that, is it on this slide? It's on the next one. I have something about an alternate translation for that. But men like Gallio are the ones that in essence, protected Paul, not overtly, but this was part of God's plan. He knew that there would be those people there that would essentially, as it were, take care of him. As Paul is encouraged during the 18 months that he's in Corinth, he realizes that God said that nobody would hurt him, mainly because we realize that Paul has a mission, as it were, further on that he'll find out about later when he gets back to Judea at the end of the third journey. But during this time, he wrote 2 Thessalonians. We can look at that and see in 2 Thessalonians, first chapter and verse 1, it says, Paul and Silvanus and Timothy unto the church of the Thessalonians and God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. And we say, well, it says Paul and Silvanus and Timothy. Oh, we don't know anybody named Silvanus, right? It turns out, though, that Silvanus is just, Silas is just a short form of Silvanus. If you look in Melvin Curry's commentary from the Truth Commentary on the book of 2 Corinthians, that's what he says, is that Silas is a short form of Silvanus. Silvanus itself is only used four times in the New Testament, in 2 Corinthians 1:19, 1 Thessalonians 1:1, 2 Thessalonians 1:1. Those are all talking about the same Silvanus. And then in 1 Peter 5:12, we have Silvanus mentioned again, but there's no context there to indicate who this Silvanus might be. But many of the people feel that this Silvanus is the same one. Clinton Hamilton, in his Truth Commentary on 1 Peter, says that no doubt he is to be identified with Silas, whom the book of Acts features prominently. Silas, he says, is the Greek form of his name, Randy Bowles.
And I think that not only had he written, I believe he wrote 1 Thessalonians soon after he got to Corinth, when Timothy showed up and gave the report, he immediately penned this letter to encourage them. And I think Timothy took it back. And now Timothy and I guess Silas have come back now with that, and now he's going to write 2 Thessalonians.
Right.
This is soon after having just left, really, in essence, Thessalonica.
Right. So he didn't have a real pleasant experience up there in Thessalonica, and so he went on to Berea, and then when those Thessalonians the ones that didn't have anything to do but persecute people followed after him, then they sent him to the sea, and he went around to Athens and then finally on to Corinth. But yeah, he would have sent the first letter to the Thessalonians, obviously before this one, to see how things were going on, to encourage them. I think we see discussions about that in the books of First Thessalonians, about him wanting to know how things were going. Messengers back and forth. It's interesting that we think about that as we're going to send a messenger here, we're going to send a messenger there. The fact of the matter is that this took a long time to do this. This was not, well, I'm going to hop on a plane, I'm going to be there tomorrow, or I'm going to be there tonight. This could be months of travel to get there, certainly weeks. So if we wanted to go from Athens all the way around the peninsula and all the way up to the top where Macedonia was, and go to Thessalonica, that's a fur piece. So, and without the kind of transportation that we have today, that would have taken a while. Yeah, probably not, as you say, Randy, not months, but certainly took an appreciable amount of time. We look at this and said, you know, it says, I sent Timothy and Silas up there to talk to these people, and then they've come back and done this, and then I sent somebody else over this way to do that. And you go, this is a long period of time we're talking about. We're not talking about getting on email or getting on the telephone or something like that and talking to these people. This is a long period of time where this is going on. So you can imagine the, I don't know, agony or angst that he would have had in his heart while waiting for response from the things. That's much when he was in Ephesus and sent the letter over to Corinth to find out how they were doing, and finally received a response back when he met Titus in Macedonia, where he was able then to write the Second Corinthian letter. But yeah, Paul was very anxious for what was going on there in that time. Silas also, the word Silas is used 13 times in the New Testament, but only in Acts 15 through 18. So we see him introduced in Acts at the beginning of Acts 15, and we see the last mention of the word Silas in Acts 18. Everyone feels that the Silvanus is the one that's being spoken of as Silas. So when we look at the introduction to 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, we see essentially the same thing. He mentions Silvanus being with him each time. And then I did write down what 2 Corinthians 1:19 was. Is anybody in that vicinity? 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians 1:19. That's an intro also. So Paul saying in the 2 Corinthian letter, 2 Corinthians 1:19, "For the Son of God, Jesus Christ, who is preached among you by us, even by me and Silvanus and Timothy, was not yea and nay, but in him is yea." We see here that he mentions the fact that he and Silvanus and Timothy were preaching. And we see in this journey that it is he and Silas and Timothy that are always together in this preaching journey. So I think that's another area where we can see that when he's talking about Silvanus, he's talking about the same person.
Verse 5 of chapter 18 of Acts talks about Timothy and Silas coming down.
Yeah, when Timothy and Silas came down from Macedonia. And so by that time, he's already in Corinth, right? And so they found him over there in Corinth. And there's other encouragement then in a number of other things that has gone on. In other words, the why none would hurt him is because there were people, as Mickey says here, that were like Gallio. There were others that he could trust. And then, of course, there's this chief captain, Claudius Lysias. Why would we think that he would be encouraged by the Lord in the fact that none would hurt him? What does Claudius Lysias have to do with that? Who is Claudius Lysias? We haven't come to him yet. Chapter 21, is it, James, where we have the riot in the temple area, and the soldiers come down and carry him up the stairs and all that? Who writes a letter then to the governor about Paul? Claudius Lysias, the chief captain, right? We would think, well, Claudius Lysias, he was over centurions. I mean, he was the senior manager.
He was the senior military guy in Jerusalem.
Yeah, yeah. And so why would we mention then Claudius Lysias? Once again, we can go back to this that we've already read in Romans, the 15th chapter, in verses 31 and 32, where Paul says, "That I may be delivered from them that are disobedient in Judea, and that my ministration which I have for Jerusalem may be acceptable to the saints, that I may come unto you in joy through the will of God, and together with you find rest." So now Paul is writing this to the Romans. Does he ever get to the Romans in the method that was talking about here? In other words, he wanted to make a visit to them, much like he was making a visit to Corinth now. He does get to visit Rome, but as it were, not under his own power. But he talks about the fact that he may be delivered. And then when we look at all the references here that are in Acts 21, 22, 23, and 24, there's numerous references to Claudius Lysias and or the chief captain, who is the same thing. And quite a number of references in there. As Claudius writes the letter to the governor says that we'll judge your matter as soon as Claudius Lysias comes up here, and so on. We understand that though Claudius Lysias wasn't essentially any friend of Paul, he kept him from harm. because that's the way that God wanted it. And so when we talk about those that would not hurt him, that it was okay for Paul to preach in Corinth, that none would set upon him to hurt him, we need to understand that indeed God's protection was there for him. That's the point that we're trying to make here, is that Paul can be encouraged by the Lord by the fact that people that weren't even Christians were helping them, perhaps inadvertently, but just in the course of their duties, were helping them out, because at least they were at least semi-honest men. Though when we look at the letter from Claudius Lysias to the governor, we realize that he, you know, sort of expanded the truth there also. Randy Bolt.
Before we leave this, I can't help but compare this passage, verses 9 through 11, with what the Lord told Elijah in 1 Kings 19, after he had the showdown there at Mount Carmel and with the priest of Baal. And Elijah then runs to the south to get away from Jezebel.
Oh, yeah. Is that the part where he says, I only am left?
Yes, he says, I'm the only one left.
Right.
God says, I've got thousands that are yet down beneath Baal.
Right. God is in charge, isn't he? I mean, we look at all of this.
And he knows how many he has.
Yeah. God rules in the kingdoms of men. And so when we look at people like Gallio and Claudius Lysias, we understand that through the providence of God, they helped the preachers of the gospel in this way. An interesting thing to keep in mind, that Paul could be encouraged by the things that the Lord has given him and helped him with regarding that. And as we continue to talk about being encouraged by the Lord, we see that, I don't like the fact that he used the word enabled. I just detest that word. When we talk about this kind of thing, he was enabled by the proconsul. Well, certainly he was, we would say, in keeping with what we've been talking about, he was encouraged by the proconsul. Gallio, the proconsul of Asia, was there at the judgment seat when these people brought Paul before him with all these charges. But Gallio didn't want to listen to them. He wasn't willing to be a judge in their religious matters. That's what he says. This is about your stuff. This is about your religion. I don't care about that. And in the American Standard Version, it says that in verse 17, and they all laid hold on Sosthenes, the ruler of the synagogue, and beat him before the judgment seat, and Gallio cared for none of these things. So in the American Standard Version, it strikes me as that Gallio didn't like the fact that they beat Sosthenes. But if we look in the English Standard Version, for example, and many of the other versions, it says something similar to, but Gallio paid no attention to any of this. Randy?
The New American Standard says that Gallio is not concerned about any of these things.
Right. So, whereas in the American Standard and the King James Version, I can look at that and think, oh, well, Gallio didn't like the fact that they beat Sosthenes. The other versions we look at, it says, Gallio couldn't care less if they beat Sosthenes or not. It didn't have anything to do with him. Didn't have anything to do with their law.
Why are you wandering?
Apparently, if a bunch of Jews beat up another Jew, that didn't violate any of their laws either. So they weren't really concerned about it at all. He says, but if there are questions about words and names and your own law, look to it yourself. Who else said look to it yourself? Pilate said that, didn't he? So this is not quite as critical as the Pilate declaration, but we understand that's what he's saying. Look to it yourself. Randy?
I was searching for a verse from earlier on in our study today, and I finally found it just in relationship to Christmas.
Okay.
Back in Acts chapter 6.
Acts 6.
Verse 7, just before Stephen's death. Verse 7 says, the word of God kept on spreading, and the number of the disciples continued to increase greatly in Jerusalem. And a great many of the priests were becoming obedient to faith.
Oh, yes.
So a great number.
A great number,
in
right.
Jerusalem.
Yeah. So there were some honest people there, too, apparently.
Honest people there, too.
Yeah. Good. Randy Bolt.
I can't help but think that maybe Gallio had learned something from Pontius Pilate. Because my understanding is infinite there were Jews over Jesus, in effect ended his career. That it wasn't long after that he was recalled to Rome.
That's true,
And that perhaps Gallio had become aware of this, and he said, the lesson to be learned is don't get involved in local religious affairs.
Yeah, would be surprised. That's right.
And if we don't know that, it's speculation.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So the next slide that we have prepared here is the Church of Corinth establishment. So no doubt that's where Mickey will take up next week.